Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're listening to Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Jaca. Excuse the stuffy nose, it is just that time of year. This week for Real College Podcast, we are looking at the unexpected, from micro picks that aren't actually that micro to scam jobs. You'll get to hear all that and my stuffy voice starting right now on Real College Podcast. Adopting a dog that grows bigger than expected is a relatively common experience. But imagine buying a pig that grows to be 300 pounds or more, and you thought it wasn't going to get any bigger than 5 or 10 pounds. This is what happens when regular pigs are passed off as micro pigs, mini pigs, or teacup pigs. Even a small pig will grow to 80, 100, even 150 pounds, so it's important to know what you're getting into when you buy a pig. Liv Riggins brings us more on what makes pigs great pets and what some of the problems with having them as a pet are.
I spoke with pet pig breeder Karen Garlick to find out more about what's behind the trend.
My name's Karen Garlick. I am the owner of Pampered Piglets. We raise pigs for pets in homes. We're one of the main breeders in the United States. There's only about 5 legitimate breeders in the U.S. that aren't raising just pigs. So, you know, we have a few breeders, and we usually have a litter or two on the ground for people to choose from. We sell them to every state in the United States, and I have shipped to Bahamas, Bermuda, Chile, Canada, various other countries as well that I fly them to, and they arrive the same day.
So what's behind the trend? What do people love so much about pigs?
Their greatest pets is they do not shed, have the odors like dogs do. You can bathe them. They dry in about 2 minutes. They're ranked the 3rd smartest animal, so you can train them tricks. You can take them on walks. You can sleep with them. They can use a litter box like a cat, or you can train them to go outside and go to the bathroom. They're just incredible pets. They get along good with children and with other pets. These are personal pets, and they're raised with the utmost love and care.
So small pigs can make adorable, intelligent, and loving companions. But there are also some ethical questions surrounding their transition from farm animals into the world of pets. It's important to have a responsible breeder and understand both the size a pig may grow to and the behaviors they'll need to engage in. Dr. Beth Ventura, a University of Minnesota assistant professor who specializes in companion animal welfare, explains why.
I have heard of not responsible breeders who maybe suggest feeding pigs to a certain level to keep them small. And of course, if we're not meeting the nutritional needs of an animal in such a way to depress their growth, that's just a huge red flag for the welfare of the animal. So many times they're surrendered because they grow much larger than they're expected. So people expect that they're going to stay really tiny, but they don't. They grow to, you know, 100, 200 pounds, which is way more than most folks would think of when they're like, I'm going to buy a little teacup pig and it's going to sit in a teacup its entire life. That's not what it does. Many times when pets are surrendered to shelters, it's because the owners are reporting kind of, quote, pet-related problems. So maybe behavioral problems, or the pet grew too big, or some other thing where the owner decided that they couldn't manage or provide for that animal anymore. And I think a lot of that can be avoided by doing the research ahead of time and investing the time to learn about what that animal needs to have a good life. It's not to say that the owners are bad or their motivations aren't, you know, pure and loving, because they are. But sometimes if we don't understand how to read the animal's behavior, or we just don't have the comprehensive knowledge that we need to provide for exactly what that animal needs, then there can be a gap between our best of intentions and our loving intentions, and that close relationship that we feel, and actually what's happening on the pig's level. And I think a lot of times people get pets not really understanding how behaviorally complex they are, what their needs really are, and we're not always prepared to meet those needs.
Almost nowhere is doing the research and understanding your pet as important as with companion pigs. Pigs aren't your average pet in terms of intelligence or behavior, and unlike with dogs and cats, most people don't have a common sense understanding of the behaviors or needs of a pig.
they have complex social groups and they're very smart. Like if you have ever spent time with a pig and you, and I'm kind of anthropomorphizing here, which I'm not supposed to do, bad scientist, but if you look at a pig and you look in their eyes, like there's someone there. And there's, I mean, I think there's someone there with our dog and our cat and our mouse as well, but pigs, I think, are kind of at this whole other level of cognitive complexity. Someone who's that complex needs a lot more to have a good life.
For pigs, this means getting outside and exploring.
They have a whole suite of motivated behaviors that they want to do. So they want to explore the world with their mouths and with their snout. But if we don't provide pigs with the appropriate substrate and the opportunities, that will generate a lot of frustration. And we'll see that frustration being exhibited in kind of undesirable behaviors. So if we keep them in a farming context and they're in a stall, they'll bite the bars a lot because they aren't able to kind of appropriately enact that kind of chewing and rooting behavior. They want to root through the dirt and they want to root through the leaves.
Just like these five-week-old pigs at Nittany View Farm.
In a pet or a companion animal situation, we could, like, owners, it's feasible for owners to provide that. Supervised outdoor time and a lot of it to allow your pig to do that kind of interesting oral exploratory behavior. That can probably help. But probably most of us aren't prepared to spend large chunks of time doing that.
Some of these lifestyle challenges that may come with having a pig aren't unique to pigs, though.
I think a lot of it honestly comes down to a lot of the welfare issues that we see with all companion animals. Often we see that people get pets more of us on a, you know, the spur of the moment, or they get them for their kids without really investing and considering, is this actually something I really want to take into my life and make a life change? Because really, any pet is going to induce a significant life change. Owning pets is a sizable financial investment, and adequately caring for the life of a pet can take, you know, thousands of dollars a year. So more research, more time, and also consideration of the financial aspects related to it.
It can be incredibly rewarding to spend time with such a smart, kind, and loving animal. But like with any pet, you have to have the time, money, and commitment to care for it. It might just take a little more of these to care for a pet pig. And to avoid any big surprises, be sure you've got a responsible pig breeder. I was raised in the country, that's a natural fact. Food on the table from the garden now back. For Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Liv Riggins. Running with your cousins from yard to yard. Living was easy, but the playing was hard. Didn't have much, nothing comes for free. All you needed was your family. Every student, specifically freshmen, dreams of landing that great paid internship in their field. But sometimes it's hard to tell if the internship of your dreams is actually what it seems to be. Audrey Kennedy has the story of a company on campus not being what students are expecting.
I first became interested in the topic of campus jobs when I walked out to see sidewalk after sidewalk covered in the same chalk words. Looking for a job? WestMetroStudents.com. 16 an hour base pay. I was curious as to what job could actually offer that, so I went to the website, expecting, well, a website. What I found was a Google Doc, and nothing else. They titled it, Student Work in Greater West Metro Area, Even If You Don't Have Experience. It had the typical questions like name, phone number, and how you heard of the program. At the end, there was a single photo, obviously ripped from a Snapchat story, of 10 to 15 college kids in a few weird outfits, taking a selfie. All the information given on the job was extremely vague, and when you Google West Metro students, nothing really comes up. I posted in the U of M Facebook group to warn people of how sketchy it was, and didn't think much of it until the next day when I went to my psychology lecture. A guy came in and did a short spiel on an internship opportunity that would be great for psychology students. He said it was paid and it's pretty competitive, but if we wrote our names down in our major, he would reach out to us to see if we were eligible. He never actually mentioned a name or what the internships would be. But I wrote my name down and got a call a week later where they wanted me to answer questions seeing if I was eligible for an interview. I was busy and asked if they could call me back. They never did. They also never gave me a name of a company or anything about it. I asked around, and apparently this guy had come into multiple huge lecture halls and given out the same pieces of paper, but never mentioned who he was or what the company did. So again, I posted in the U of M Facebook group, asking if anyone had any experience with these sketchy companies. I was flooded with messages and comments saying, "Oh yeah, I was wondering what that was," or, "They came into my lecture hall a few weeks ago passing around papers." I had no shortage of people who have had experiences with some sort of weird company advertising to students. For the record, West Metro Students, which also advertises itself as gopherwork.com all around campus in chalk, is a company called Vector Marketing, which sells Cutco knives. That guy who came into my class, though, a different story. After a little digging, I found out the company was called College Works, and it's actually a painting company that hires you to paint houses for a summer. They advertise it as starting your own business. You recruit a team to try and find work, but at the end, College Works takes 40% of your profits, and you're responsible for all costs and expenses. I looked around to see if anyone had gone through with the interview they said I might be eligible for on the phone call. I received a message from a girl named Claire, who had interviewed with College Works her freshman year at the U. Here's Claire to talk about her experience. Can you introduce yourself? Just say, like, your name and major.
I'm Claire. I'm majoring in ecology, evolution, and behavior, and minoring in marine biology.
So how did you hear about the quote-unquote job?
They came into my physics lecture when I was a freshman. They handed out little sheets. You put your name, number, and major on, and they told you they would find an internship that would fit you perfectly. When the people come in, they come in right before the professor starts teaching, so they get like a list of class times when the lecture halls are going to be the most full, and they generally go to lower level classrooms, so like 1,000 levels, because it's mainly freshmen, and then they will hand out the slips. They're like, "Oh, I have a quick announcement. I'm with College Works. We pair you up in internships." So it sounds like it's kind of like a temp agency, but for college kids with internships rather than jobs. But the professors have no idea they're coming in. They just assume they're with part of the university. They focused on internship opportunity. Like, they just kept saying that. And it was like, "It'll be the perfect fit for you. Just fill this out." About 6 weeks later, they called back saying they found something that would work, that there would be an internship with like a minimum of $10,000 you'd get from it. So I was young, naive, and excited, and I agreed to meet up for an interview.
So what was the internship?
They didn't tell you until the middle of the interview, and it was a group interview, which was kind of strange, but you would be painting houses. So they kind of pinned us against each other a little bit, describing why we would be good or better than the next person. And I thought it was fishy right away, so I started asking questions. And the person leading it told me, "I can't answer that until we decide if you're selected for the next interview." So he was getting a little snippety and wouldn't give me a straight answer about anything.
Did anybody around you or you have any sort of reaction when they said painting?
Pretty much all of us were disappointed we spent our time there when we found out we were painting houses. And we didn't really want anything to do with it after that point.
I'm assuming you did not accept, right?
No, I left the interview early. I had a second interview over the phone, which he called me. I didn't answer. And then he left a voicemail. He's like, "Call me back as soon as you can. I really want to talk to you. You'd be a good fit," and all this other stuff. And I didn't respond to him.
Did you look into the company at all afterwards just to see what it was?
Yeah, I was wondering how it could be allowed on campus because it did seem like a pyramid scheme. So I started looking into it, and it's not really a pyramid scheme, but it is a high-risk internship, and they're very vague about that. So they draw in a lot of excited freshmen who don't really know what's going on. And by the time freshmen realize they're in over their head, they invested so much time in it already, they either quit right there and take their losses or they try to finish it out.
Do you think it qualifies as an internship, in your opinion?
Not at all. It's a small business that you learn how to run on your own, and then they take, I think, 40% of your profits. So you'd be better off just starting your own business and keeping everything.
Under CollegeWorks FAQs, they have a link to another page on their website called CollegeWorks Painting, Scam Advice for Students. Their first point is to learn how to identify a pyramid scheme, which they then follow with, CollegeWorks is not a pyramid scheme. Take of that what you will. And know that if you see a website written in chalk on the sidewalk, it's probably for vector marketing, and they won't stop calling you once you give them your phone number. Trust me, I'm on my third call this week. Thanks to Claire for sharing her comments and experience. For Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Audrey Kennedy.
There are some pretty big misconceptions surrounding arranged marriage, namely the assumption that everyone who has an arranged marriage has one set opinion on it. Vishnu pulls back the curtain and dives deep on arranged marriages.
If you were ever on an American playground in the past 100 years or so, you've probably heard this song. Let's rewind that for a second. First comes love, and then comes marriage. Such is the case, but not for everyone. In fact, if you were to go outside of Western convention, the song would probably be reverse. First comes marriage, then comes love.
What was the criteria for you?
My parents should approve, so they picked the person.
So you actually arrange marriages for, like...
Not quite, but we arrange to the extent that we gave them choices, and they pick from the choice.
How did you reach the choices?
Through advertisement in the matrimonial columns.
Really?
Yes.
So you went to the newspaper?
No, it's by the time it was web or okay. In some actually my younger son's Christian side, it was web was already developed. In Gupta's side, it was time it was asking people who you know to give us suggestions.
Right.
In our culture, you always want to marry the same caste or whatever it is. Yeah. But the movies is different. You can marry anybody you want. You love somebody and you said.
You dream about and all that. You know, it is not reality. Movie is not reality. It could be your fascination, your imagination that's coming out.
Right.
Yeah. And why do people say that you have to marry from the same group, right? You know, as Brahmins, because if you marry somebody from another caste back home, they could be eating meat, and it's hard to adapt and adjust to the other culture, right? You know, so that's why people stay in the same group, and it became a taboo to marry somebody from another caste.
What if, for example, right? You get married to someone, and you just don't like them. That's it.
Arranged marriage, right?
Yeah.
That's common.
It's common.
Mm-hmm. Marriage. What's marriage? Marriage is all about adjusting and adapting to another person and personality, right? No two personalities are going to be the same. Then the world will be boring.
Yeah.
Don't you agree?
Yeah.
So it's all about adjusting and adapting.
Right.
You marry somebody and you probably don't like that person, but the sake of the family and the community, you suffer it. But now, the norm is changing. If you don't like somebody, I cannot live with this person, I'll get divorced. You know, that's a common thing nowadays.
Marriage is an institution, and if you really care about someone, it doesn't matter if you're you're not in a marriage per se. I think people who have arranged marriages, they fall into love rather than are already in love, and then instead of having it dissipate, it ends up growing stronger as they move on. And then I also feel that in the modern day context, I think it depends on how you feel about the institution of marriage. Like, if you want to get married and you want to find someone yourself, you should be able to. But if you don't, if you're lazy like me and you don't want to put in the effort, I think having the knowledge that you, if you trust your parents enough, having the knowledge that your parents have, they'd probably find you someone that could give you a good life.
It's changed a lot from what it used to be. Uh-huh. So it's kind of more like an expedited like dating process.
Okay.
And so in that sense, it's kind of like Tinder, except your parents are the facilitators, you know? So in that sense, I'm pretty okay with it. But in the traditional sense of arranged marriage, where you don't even know the person, you meet them once and you get married, I feel like we need a little more legroom than that.
So what do you think is different between like the Western ideal of love versus like the Eastern Indian ideal of love? Like, what do you think, how do you think love differs within these two cultural contexts?
So it kind of reflects the societal standards as well. So West is a very, or Western cultures are very individualistic, focus on the individual, your own independence, etc. But in the East, it's a very communal culture, and what you do isn't reflected only on you, but on your family and the others around you. So I feel like that's reflected back in the ideals of love. So when you fall in love in Western cultures, you're looking for personal happiness and personal fulfillment. But I feel like Eastern ideals of love are focused not only on how you feel, but how you feel affects others around you and the community and your family as well.
Statistically, arranged marriages last longer because you work about getting people who are compatible.
So why is that better than just like picking their own partners? Why doesn't that work as well?
Because they get married or they get together on a whim, on an emotionally hormonal, you know, like, oh God, I love you, let's get married, and then we're divorced in 3 years.
Because statistically. Because you fall out of love.
Look, I've been in a number of relationships. I thought I was in love. They ended. You know, what is love?
What is love?
I think maybe sometimes that's a really hard question to answer. Maybe love is simply a long-term commitment and compatibility, more than an emotional high. You see these interviews about people who are, like, you know, 95 and they're like still their best friends, and I mean, come on, you know they're not in these huge emotional, oh my God, I love you kind of things, but they're like, maybe it means like super best friends.
Super best friends.
I like that.
That's good.
Oh my God.
That's a great answer. Lifetime super best friend. You're my best.
The leather community, which encompasses all sexual and action preferences from BDSM to fetishes, has been limited to discussions in the dark, at bars late at night, or clubs. One local organization is helping to eliminate the shame in this community by bringing it into the light. Reporter Emily Allen sat down with one of the business owners to find out how.
We originally opened in December of 2012. We were at a different location, and it was in the basement of a mansion near Loring Park, actually. So we had to close due to a zoning issue, but we decided, let's see if we can take the energy of everything we've done in the last 6 months, because we found that we would have clients, you know, they would want to stick around and just hang out and be part of the community. And it was like, how do we take that energy and make it into something bigger and better?
That's Tynan Fox, co-owner for Twin Cities Leather and Latte. Since 2012, they've been selling kink and BDSM-related leather goods, but they do a little bit more than just sell. They actually make their leather harnesses, they repair and tailor leather goods for clients, and they offer a community for people of all kinks. Also, they sell coffee.
It gives people an opportunity to feel like they are being themselves when they're not at a bar, you know? It's kind of hard, I guess, for some kinky people to be able to reconcile their kink or their fetish or who they are as a person without necessarily being around a bar late at night. And we're kind of bringing Leather into the light, I guess is a good way to think about it.
Twin Cities Leather and Latte is a small business located on Hennepin Avenue in a two-story building that looks a little bit like a house. Downstairs is the coffee shop and where they sell the leather. Upstairs is the workshop where they design and make the harnesses. The team at Twin Cities Leather and Latte is small, but they're dedicated.
We have always said, and we've never shied away from the idea that we are a kinky business. We're owned by kinky people, and we're here for kinky people. There's myself and my business partner, Carrie, that I was talking about. We are the two owners, and then we have a staff of five baristas that all work for us at the counter and sell things on the sales floor. And Kurt is actually working right now. He's one of the one of our staff members that helps out on the workbench upstairs as well.
Here's Kurt talking about staff responsibilities.
So being a barista here is kind of a multifaceted job because you do have multiple responsibilities. So, I mean, we are Leather and Latte. So, yes, the majority of our customers will come in and have the typical coffee shop experience with the atmosphere that I'm sure Tynan kind of expanded on. But we also do take care of the leather here in the back. So when customers will come in for a fitting, all of our leather work is entirely custom. So as a barista, you do take care of fittings like that, entering in orders and making sure that customers get exactly what they want and they have a great experience.
After sitting in the coffee shop area to talk with Tynan, we moved on to check out the leather products, including the harnesses they make in the store.
These are just some of our harnesses we make. Like, we make all of these from scratch. We buy leather hides from various retailers, and I mean, we cut them up, glue them, stitch them, punch holes and set snaps and rivets into all of them. So these are all made with our own two hands. There's very few of them that leave the store without having been touched by one of us.
I see these teddy bear designs, bicycle designs. How do you choose the fabric? Is there a reason for specific types?
Yes, these are actually what we call the ABDL harnesses. That stands for adult baby / diaper lover. This is one of the newest designs in our collection. It's one of the many examples of how we really reach out to people, no matter what their kink or fetish is. It's not really just confined to leather, because we realize that you didn't choose your kink or your fetish. For many people out there, especially myself, whatever your fetish is, it's been with you since the beginning of time, and nothing you do is ever going to change that.
Upstairs, I got to see the workspace where the harnesses are made. There's a couch on one end of the room where Tynan says staff can take a break, but the space is mostly occupied by leather hides, hanging from the wall, draped on the tables, spread out on the floor. You can hear Carrie, the designer, working with the leather while Tynan talks about the space.
But this is where all the magic happens. As you can see, we kind of take a little bit of a... We have a spot where we can rest, but this is mostly our workstation and backstock, really, and storage. We have just the one sewing machine. Carrie does the vast majority of the sewing. And obviously, like I said, all of the design, I just kind of help out when I'm told to.
Twin Cities Leather and Latte is at 2717 Hennepin Avenue in Minneapolis. They also have a website.
Don't forget, you can shop online at twincitiesleather.com.
Does that include coffee too, or just leather?
Just leather. It's kind of hard to run an online cafe.
For Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Emily Allen.
That is all for this week's episode of Real College Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. You can hear all our episodes at radiok.org/Real College Podcast. You can also subscribe on iTunes. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It's produced by Alex Schumacher, Emily Allen, and Liv Riggins. I'm your host and managing editor, Jacob Maldonado Medina. Thanks for listening and tune in every Monday at 6:30 for arts and culture coverage.